Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Inner Athlete. I'm your host, James Jankowicz, and as usual, we have a great show for you this evening. We have a guest in studio who'll be coming on in just a little while, Catherine Farrell, who's a registered dietitian, and she'll be giving us the newest updates on diabetes. In that vein, I just wanted to take a minute to go over something that we go over quite frequently on this program, but we can't go over it enough. And that's the role of exercise in disease prevention. Because there are just so many diseases out there, so many conditions that can be prevented and even reversed with even the most remedial of lifestyle changes. And the one we emphasize a lot on this program is exercise, and we've gone over that in great detail, and certainly nutrition. But just wanted to give you some stats so we can get a real grip on this thing. And this is from the Centers for Disease Control and from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So essentially what we're looking at is the causes, the 10 leading causes of death in both men and women. And right up there for both men and women is heart disease. That's right up there at about 20 and some odd percent. And second to that is cancer. So heart disease and cancer. Now, it doesn't go into great detail about which kinds of cancer, but it just simply says cancer. But we've done extensive shows here on the role of cancer prevention, breast cancer prevention, colorectal cancer prevention, in just by making dietary and intense exercise changes in your lifestyle. And so we're looking at those two right at the top, heart disease and cancer. For men, number three is unintentional injuries, because we're basically jackasses. We do a lot of, and that's what the article says, basically. We do a lot more potentially injurious things to ourselves than women do. We tend to take a lot more physical risks than women do. So we tend to experience unintentional injuries or unintentional death much more frequently than women do. For women, right in number three is stroke. And that's number four for men. So we know heart disease is preventable on a lot of levels. Cancer is preventable on a lot of levels. Unintentional injuries, definitely preventable. And stroke. Stroke is right up there with heart disease. Right underneath that, then, would be chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and for women that would be chronic lower respiratory disease. And then number six for both is diabetes, and that's what we'll be speaking about in just a little while with our guest Catherine Farrell. And then it goes on to flu and pneumonia, kidney disease, chronic liver disease in men, and septicemia in women, which is basically toxicity of the blood. So there you have it. You have the top 10, and not to make it a Letterman top 10 list, but basically you have the top 10 causes of death in the United States, and these are so preventable. Now, everybody might, there are people out there who might have a genetic disposition to certain conditions, in which case that is not a sentence either, because if you have a genetic disposition, it just means you need to be a little more careful with your lifestyle choices. But I can't emphasize it enough. The more you're out there exercising, the more you're sweating. The more you're sweating, the more you're the more you're releasing toxins. Because remember, the more you urinate, the more you sweat, the more you defecate, literally, the more toxins you'll be releasing from your body. The more you exercise, the more stimulation to your lymphatic system, to your circulatory system. And the lymphatic system, remember, that's a, we've done a whole show on that alone, but just keep in mind, that's the method by which a lot of toxins are released through your body. And unlike the circulatory system, which has a heart which pumps the blood through the body, the lymphatic system does not have such a pump. So the more you exercise, the more the muscles contract and then relax, essentially the more you're pumping, the more you're stimulating the lymphatic system. So all of that, the sweating, the working out of the heart, the increased activation of the lymphatic system, All that just goes so far in disease prevention. And then, of course, drinking clean water and eating primarily an organic foods diet, all that just, you know, goes a really, really, really long way. And this is from the Mayo Clinic, just to drive the point home a little bit more. What aerobic exercises does for your health? And it says, and I'm quoting, regardless of your age, weight, or athletic ability, aerobic exercise is good for you. As your body adapts to regular aerobic exercise, you'll get stronger and more efficient. Consider some of the many ways that aerobic exercise can help you feel better and enjoy life to the fullest. Then it goes on to mention some of the items. Reduce health risks. Aerobic exercise reduces the risk of many conditions, including obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, stroke, and certain types of cancer. Weight-bearing aerobic exercises, such as walking, reduce the risk of osteoporosis. Secondly, they help you manage chronic conditions. Aerobic exercise helps lower high blood pressure, control blood sugar, and relieve chronic muscle pain. If you've had a heart attack, aerobic exercise can prevent subsequent attacks. Keep excess pounds at bay. Combined with a healthy diet, aerobic exercise can help you lose weight and keep it off. Ward off viral illnesses. Aerobic exercise activates your immune system. This leaves you less susceptible to minor viral illnesses such as cold and flu. And the other benefit to that as well, when you talk about aerobic exercise, is you're consuming a lot of oxygen. And I know we've gone over this before, but it warrants a reminder that a highly oxygenated environment makes it very tough for the things that infect us to thrive. In other words, a highly oxygenated environment, it's very tough for viruses, for bacteria, for fungus, for all that kind of stuff to thrive in a highly oxygenated environment. So when you do exercise and you're exercising outdoors and you're consuming high volumes of oxygen, that's good. All right. Now, it has a downside because it does create an onslaught of free radicals, and that can be quenched with the consumption of antioxidants. And that's where that word comes from, antioxidants, because when you oxidize yourself, when you consume a lot of oxygen, that'll have as good as it is for you, it is a Jekyll and Hyde kind of molecule. It can also be your downfall. So by taking antioxidants, the components that are antioxidizing, that helps neutralize the negative side of oxygenation. So, yeah, oxygenation is a weird one. You really need it. It's very hard for cancer and viruses and of the like to thrive in a highly oxygenated environment. But by the same token, oxygen has its own inherent destructive pathways as well. So on to the next one. Back to the benefits of aerobic exercise. Keeping your arteries clear. Aerobic exercise increases the concentration of high-density lipoprotein, HDLs, or good cholesterol, and decreases the concentration of low-density lipoproteins, LDL, or bad cholesterol in your blood. The potential result, less buildup of plaque in your arteries. It strengthens your heart. A stronger heart doesn't need to beat as fast. A stronger heart also pumps blood more efficiently, which improves blood flow to all parts of your body. Because remember, that's what's happening when you take your blood pressure. You're essentially trying to evaluate how hard is your heart working. But 139 and above is borderline right into hypertension. And that's all that, when you get your blood pressure measured, that's essentially all you're determining, really, is, you know, how hard is your heart working. Because the more clogged your arteries are, the more the heart is going to have to push, and the harder it's going to have to work in order to push the blood through the body. Boost your mood. Aerobic exercise can ease the gloominess of depression and reduce the tension associated with anxiety, as well as promote relaxation. And we've all experienced that with the release of endorphins and that whole other pharmacopoeia, internal pharmacopoeia of chemicals inside your body that are released when you exercise. Same ones that are released when you're feeling good, when you're dancing, when you are in a particularly good mood. It's all the same biochemical pathways, and they're induced when you exercise. and increases your stamina. Aerobic exercise may make you feel tired in the short term, but over the long term, you'll enjoy increased stamina and reduced fatigue. And anybody who's exercised for a long time knows that. And it helps you stay active and independent as you get older. Aerobic exercise keeps your muscles strong, which can help maintain mobility as you get older. Aerobic exercise also keeps your mind sharp. Researchers say that at least 30 minutes of aerobic exercise 3 days a week can reduce cognitive decline in older adults. And there's a great book on that called Sparks by a gentleman named John Rady. And I highly recommend that book. We did a review on it some time ago. But that's all about how that works, because so many studies have come out saying that increased aerobic exercise does actually help produce more brain cells. They've seen it in rats, and they've seen conclusive evidence of it, demonstrative evidence of it in human beings as well. So not only will it sharpen your body, but it'll sharpen your mind as well. Sometimes you see people exercising, and you see them on a machine, and they might be reading, or they might be engaged in a book, or they might be engaged in a TV show. And sometimes that's good, because now you have your body working literally on all different levels. You have your nervous system working, trying to stabilize you on the treadmill or the bike or the elliptical trainer or whatever you happen to be on. Your mind is completely activated if you are reading something. And now you have all systems go, and all this is being activated simultaneously. So on a nervous system level, yeah, that's not so bad. The downside of that is sometimes when people get so engrossed in what they're reading or what they're watching that they may neglect the intensity at which they're working. And yeah, that's the downside. But there is an upside to it as well. So that's what this particular evening show is all about. It's about these leading causes of death, to understand them, to understand how preventable they are. And the one we're going to focus on is diabetes. And again, coming up in a couple moments, we'll have Catherine Farrell, who's a certified diabetes specialist, educator, rather, and registered dietitian. So what we'll do is we'll go to break, then we'll come back. And I want to just remind you that we could be found at innerathletetraining.com. InnerAthleteTraining.com. If you have any questions or issues you'd like to discuss, keep the mail coming. The questions are very provocative, and I'd like to address them as they come up. And more articles are being posted on there. And come January, we have a whole new lineup of guests that we're going to be having on, and we're going to be updating the website as well at that point. So, but in the meantime, InnerAthleteTraining.com. All right, just stay with us, and we'll be right back right after this.
I'm a desperate man. guns and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money. And lawyers, guns and money. And lawyers, guns and money.
Welcome back to The Inner Athlete. I'm your host, James Jankowicz. And don't forget to visit us at innerathletetraining.com. So we have a guest in studio today, and we wanted to discuss something that's affecting a lot of Americans, and that's diabetes. And I quote from the Centers for Disease Control's own stats, diabetes now affects nearly 21 million Americans, or 7% of the United States population. And more than 6 million of those people do not know they have diabetes, according to the latest prevalence data released today by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This number represents an additional 2.6 million people with diabetes since 2002. Another 41 million people are estimated to have prediabetes, and that's a condition that increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And that's the most common form of the disease, as well as heart disease and stroke. So here to help explain what this phenomenon is all about is Catherine Farrell. Catherine's a New York State registered or certified dietitian and nutritionist. She's a registered dietitian, a certified diabetes educator, and a certified adult weight management educator as well. So Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
And if you can just walk us through, I mean, people who listen to this program have a wide variety of education, but let's just start from the basics before we even get into the stats and what this all means. What is diabetes?
Well, diabetes is a state of impaired glucose function within our systems, our carbohydrate metabolism, and the onset is really, there's three different types of diabetes. One where our bodies stop producing insulin when there's an acute onset attack or autoimmune attack.
Okay, let's step back.
Sure.
What's the role of insulin in our bodies?
Insulin,
when you say the body doesn't produce it, what does insulin do?
Well, insulin's produced in our pancreas, and it is the key to unlocking the glucose from our bloodstream into our cells, and that gives us units of energy. And without insulin, we actually do need insulin to be able to function optimally. But when there is insulin resistance or decreased production of insulin, end result will be that the blood glucose levels will be increased, and the cells within our systems and organs and other functions will start to be affected, and there'll be some, I guess, deterioration in different systems. There's different, I guess, organs that are affected, in particularly there's your kidneys, your liver, the increased risk for cardiovascular disease. People with diabetes have 2 to 4 times increased rate of heart disease. Some of the other complications would be retinopathy, blindness, kidney disease, nephropathy, which is what it's called, and also neuropathy. So there's decreased wound healing, and there's also a high correlation with people with amputations as a result of having diabetes.
Why amputations?
Well, that goes along with decreased wound healing in the extremities. So someone could have, you know, the most simple tiny abrasion or cut, say, on their foot or other extremity, and because of decreased blood supply and circulation in that area, or even with, you know, neuropathy, they may not even feel that they have any type of wound or cut. And then there's decreased wound healing, so that the wound tends to become more exaggerated and can lead to gangrene. And from there, to save the person's life, they wind up having to amputate.
Okay. So what are, there are two types of diabetes?
Well, with type 1, which is only really about 5% of people with diabetes, have type 1 diabetes. And that used to be called juvenile onset or juvenile diabetes, because we would only see that in children, where there would be, I guess, decrease or a cease of production of insulin in the beta cells from in the pancreas. And the person would have what's called polydipsia, polyuria, polyphagia. So they become very thirsty.
What are those conditions?
Very thirsty, increased thirst, increased hunger, increased urination, and then with, you know, marked hyperglycemia, they would wind up in a coma, or, you know, you would find out very quickly when you would have the onset of type 1 diabetes. And your pancreas basically stops producing insulin, so therefore the rest of your cells in your body does not receive all the energy and glucose in your bloodstream from all the food that you're eating, and it's a life or death situation. So they require exogenous or outside insulin to help them survive. So people with type 1 diabetes rely on insulin to be able to survive. And we are actually seeing people, you know, as old as in their 20s or 30s with this type of diabetes onset. It's not only in children. However, we don't usually call it type or juvenile diabetes anymore, because we are seeing an increase of children that are obese that are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at a very young age. So the difference between type 1 and type 2 is that type 2 is that your pancreas produces insulin, but your body becomes either resistant or it's just not producing enough insulin, and it therefore you have blood glucose, I guess.
And how would that happen? Because type 2 is technically adult onset diabetes, so this occurs later on in life. And what are some of the factors that would...
Well, the type 2 can happen as young as you know, in childhood as well. And obesity plays a large role in this, because of the fact that with, you know, increased obesity, some of the comorbidities, I mean, I guess the main one would be next to heart disease would be diabetes, because the uptake of the glucose into the cells is impaired if insulin isn't actually working properly. And I can get into the details with that another time, but there's just a high correlation with people that are obese with having insulin resistance or impaired glucose uptake. So we are seeing children being diagnosed with type 2. So there's no longer the distinguishing between adult onset or juvenile anymore. It's type 1 or type 2. And now there's a prevalence of type 2 diabetes, just like with the obesity epidemic. Now, you know, there are type 2 diabetics or diabetes patients that are in childbearing age. So they're also conceiving and becoming pregnant while having diabetes, whereas previously gestational diabetes is really something that was seen in someone that was maybe at risk for type 2 later on in life. So, you know, they would have impaired glucose tolerance during pregnancy, say during week 24 or 26, and they would have to go on insulin and to really watch their diet and to make sure that they're taking care of, you know, monitoring their blood sugar during the pregnancy so that there's no fetal complications. And usually goes back to normal. The blood sugar goes back to normal once the person delivers. But what if a person's diabetic before they conceive, then they have the entire 9 months to make sure that they have really tight control of their blood sugar.
And aside from obesity, what are some of the other conditions that might precipitate diabetes?
Well, the obesity, our diets, and, you know, there's genetic factors, there's environmental factors, there's different theories of, you know, whether or not it's a certain attack, an autoimmune attack, some sort of a virus that could, I would say that's probably a very, very small percentage of people that develop type 1 or type 2 or type 2 at a young age that, you know, that aren't overweight. I mean, I've seen some strange cases of people being diagnosed and it's pretty ambiguous to whether or not they have type 1 or type 2, and they eventually become more of a type 1 presentation later. But I'd say the majority of people with type 2 diabetes, which is 95% of people with diabetes, really, it's really a result of our lifestyle. It's a result of our the lifestyle resulting disease, and it's something that we can control by our diet and our activity level, and you know, just taking care of our overall environment. So,
explain glucose a little bit. This is the energy molecule that insulin is supposed to deliver into the cell.
Right.
What's glucose? What's a carbohydrate? Just explain that whole hierarchy.
Well, everything we consume, carbohydrates, fat, and protein, is pretty much converted into blood glucose, and that is the simplest form of sugar, which also delivers the units of energy to all of our cells to make our bodies function. Whether, you know, it's to make your heart beat and to make your brain function, have your muscles be able to function as well, just to give us energy throughout the day to think and to move. So we need, you know, glucose to survive, and we do need carbohydrates as a main source of energy. But because of, you know, the types of foods people are consuming, they're consuming too much food, and they're consuming poor quality food, that which is contributing to higher, you know, spikes in our blood sugar and more demand of insulin production, which really, I think, just kind of overwhelms the pancreas and the amount of insulin has to produce, and eventually it starts to not produce enough, or the cells become resistant to the insulin because of the fact that as you become obese, the cells actually, the size of the cells change, and that I guess the receptors don't really match up between the cell receptors and the insulin. I mean, it can get really technical. I usually draw pictures when I explain this to people,
right.
But so there's a high correlation with what we're eating to, you know, how well our body's utilizing those nutrients. And it's important for people to understand that everything you consume is going to affect our systems in some way. And, you know, it should be in a positive way, but time and time again, after feeding ourselves improperly or overfeeding ourselves, is only going to wreak havoc on our systems. And diabetes is, the main type of disease or disorder that is a result of poor diet. I mean, you may have or may not have the genetic predisposition to develop it, but it's important for people to understand that what we are consuming and our lifestyle choices really can kind of increase or decrease our risk factors for developing the type 2 diabetes.
What's the epidemiological history? How long have we as a species have seen diabetes, and how has it evolved? And
I mean, it's been around for ages. I mean, there's things that you could read back, I mean, books or notes written as far as back as the Greeks, that, you know, noting sugar in the urine and the you know, how they would, I mean, the people really didn't last too long once they became diabetic, but that's been noted throughout history, this diabetes or the insulin resistance or decrease in insulin production has been noted for ages, but the prevalence of it and the onset has completely changed drastically over the past 15 years with the increase of obesity.
And is that worldwide or just here in the United States?
Well, it's mainly a Western issue, but as there's globalization of our food supplies and, you know, many of the Eastern cultures who typically never had a weight issue, they had foods introduced to their diet, Western foods, fast foods, those types of things, introduced to some of these Eastern cultures, and they're actually experiencing a spike in incidences of diabetes, type 2 specifically, and obesity. So it's something that they're studying, the effects of the Western diet on everybody, really. People that move here to the United States from other countries, we see an increased risk, especially in the Asian population. They seem to have a very high risk factor for developing diabetes once eating the refined type foods and processed foods that is typically found in America.
And how do we chart it here in the United States? When have we seen the biggest rise in it? since the 40s, since the 50s, since...
Oh, since 1985 is where we started to gather more data about the prevalence of obesity. But I'd say we've had more of a spike in the past 10 years. I was mentioning earlier that there's been a 250% increase in diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in New York, New Yorkers, just in the past 10 years, which is astonishing. And there was a New York Times...
What's the percentage?
250% increase in diagnoses of
diabetes
in New York City. And...
Any other parts of the country where we've seen some, such a dramatic spike?
Absolutely. In areas where, I'd say more in the Midwest and the South, I mean, if you travel around the United States, you see what areas there, when people are eating more, you know, at chain restaurants and fast food, and they're in what we call in these food deserts where, or supermarket deserts, where they don't really have access to healthy, wholesome food. And that kind of goes along with, align with the globalization of food production and how very few companies now control the majority of production of the food that we eat. And, you know, people, I mean, I've counseled thousands of people over the past, you know, 8 years, and I have actually met children who really couldn't even identify what a vegetable was because they've grown up on fast food. And literally, you know, the closest grocery store was a bodega, and the most convenient thing for their parents to feed them was McDonald's. So it's, you know, I think the United States is not the only country that has this issue, and it's a rising issue in many other countries, but I think the quality of our food supply and how cheap food has become, and I mean, that's kind of been more of a change more recently with the economic environment and cost of food, but it's something that, you know, over the past 10 years, it's become very, very easy to eat, you know, very, very cheaply and in abundance. And people usually go to restaurants if they tend to go to places where they give you a lot of food and they see, you know, more value and they want to get their money's worth and these all-you-can-eat buffets and yeah. Such. So
I'm amazed. Like, whenever I go out to eat, it's always far more food than I would ever consume in one sitting. And then they look at you like, you know, how come you're not eating it?
Right.
It's like, why are you serving me so much? And I've just seen that grow. What are some of the common symptoms? If somebody has diabetes, what are some of the early stage symptoms that they would encounter?
Of symptoms of hyperglycemia or high blood sugar? Well, I mean, there's many things. Like I mentioned with, you know, them being very thirsty or extra hungry, this is where you're in a state of having high blood sugar. Dry skin, some other, I guess, little signals that people may not always associate with having high blood sugar. But, you know, dry skin, blurred vision, frequent urination, and, you know, excess hunger. Usually is the mark of an onset of diabetes. And many times people don't have any symptoms at all, and that's the scary part. People could be walking around and have absolutely no idea. But the majority of people that are walking around that have no idea are also the ones that aren't really checking to see what their health is. And the first thing when I counsel someone is I ask, you know, when was the last time you had a physical? And to see, you know, what your baseline is, you know, what is your fasting blood sugar and what is your lipid profile and all that.
And explain what the fasting blood sugar is. How does that work? And what are the appropriate numbers?
Well, fasting blood sugar, you would have to go, I guess, at least 12 hours without eating or drinking or eating anything or drinking anything of caloric value before doing blood work. And at the fasting state, you'd be able to see what your body's I guess, regular amount of glucose in your bloodstream would be. And the normal level would be anywhere from 70 to 110, or 70 to 100, depending on, there's a different reference ranges. But, so that would be normal for fasting blood sugar. For a diagnosis of diabetes, you would have to have a fasting blood sugar of 126 milligrams per deciliter. But those that fall in between, where they may have a blood sugar of anywhere over, say, whether the reference range is, you know, 111 to 125, you would be considered in that range of a metabolic syndrome or insulin-resistant state, where your body's starting to have a little bit more resistance to or decreased production of insulin. And that's just a red flag. And I've counseled many people who may not be, you know, very much overweight, in their mind, maybe 10, 15 pounds, and may fall in this category, or they could be, you know, severely overweight and just in that category where they're, you know, in between that 111 and 125. But, I mean, it's a very clear-cut diagnosis. You either have it or you don't. And for those who think they may have slight diabetes or a mild touch of it, it's not really the case. You either have it or you don't. And it's just important for you to get the straight diagnosis or answer from a doctor. I've seen so many people that have, the doctors haven't come straight out and told them you have diabetes.
Well, then if you're asymptomatic, what happens eventually? I mean, if you're not having the common symptoms, do you just wake up one day and all of a sudden you're, like, how does somebody who's asymptomatic understand they have diabetes? That's like, well, what's going to happen to them eventually?
Well, there's a systematic shutdown. I mean, they're at higher risk for, you know, heart attack or stroke. Like I said, they're at higher risk for blindness and kidney failure and decreased wound healing that could lead to gangrene and amputation.
So you could just literally have a stroke one day. You could be asymptomatic, experience a stroke, and that stroke could have been brought on by
diabetes. The complications of diabetes, which is increase of, like, risk of heart disease and high blood pressure, and that wreaks havoc on all of our systems or organs and blood vessels. So, absolutely. I mean, all these underlying, it's not just the fact that you have high blood sugar. It's what that means. It's how it's affecting all the functions of all of your other organs in your body. And for a person who has diabetes and they check their blood sugar, they need to have that connection to understand, well, what happens with chronic hyperglycemia? What happens with when your blood sugar is high on a regular basis? It causes damage on a, you know, slowly but sure. It's a progressive disease, so it's something that you have to monitor and you have to control on a daily basis. And it's actually one of those diseases that, you know, if you had to choose of any of them that you had to pick, you had to pick a disease to have, this is the one that we've done the most research and the most ways to control it through, you know, monitoring and diet and exercise and medication. There's many ways of controlling and living a very happy, healthy life with diabetes. It's just a matter of being aware and being proactive and just knowing your facts and figures.
Okay. We'll get more into that in a moment. You're listening to The Inner Athlete. You can visit us at innerathletetraining.com, and we're speaking with Catherine Farrell, a registered dietitian, and we're discussing diabetes. We'll be back right after this. You better not gamble. And welcome back to The InterAthlete. I'm your host, James Jankowicz, and with us today in studio is Catherine Farrell, registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator. And that's our topic. That's what we're discussing is diabetes. So, all right, Catherine, so let's break this down a little bit more. We understand what it is now from the first section. So go in a little more detail about our food, how that contributes to it, how obesity contributes to it, and then we'll talk about diet and exercise, which are obviously two very inexpensive, preventable things that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what's contributed to diabetes? I mean, there's so many factors. Basically, the lifestyle that Americans usually lead, we're sedentary. Many people, you know, wake up in the morning, they get ready, they get in a car, they drive to their office, they get out, they sit in their, you know, in their office at the desk. Then they get up and they go back home and they're sitting on the couch. And what are they doing all in between? They're eating. And they're eating convenient food. They're eating foods that typically are high in saturated fat and sodium, and high in, you know, high fructose corn syrup, a lot of, or artificial sweeteners, artificial coloring. They're eating a lot of processed foods. They're eating what's convenient and they're eating just too much of it. And it, gradually, you know, I teach a weight management class, and one of the questions I ask people are, you know, how does your weight compare to when you were 18? How does your weight now compare to when you were 18? And everyone usually starts laughing hysterically because they think, oh, my goodness, you know, I was so much thinner when I was 18. And so it just goes to show that, you know, the way you're eating throughout your childhood and adolescence and when you're a teenager and when you're an actual adult, you need to really think about the implications of, you know, a consistent basis of how that's going to add to your weight and to your health overall. So I think many Americans just haven't put much thought into that, and they're just mindlessly eating. They're eating for fun. People, you know, food has become more of a, and cooking has become a spectator sport, and many people, you know, watch cooking shows on a regular basis, and but they don't know how to cook. They'll go out to restaurants and, you know, they'll just eat whatever's put in front of them. In addition, the food service industry is really serving us bigger portions. I mean, you compare the portion sizes of foods from, you know, even 20 years ago and to now, and it's almost doubled in size. And even it goes down to even like our dinnerware and our plates and bowls and cups. When I now ask people how much water you drink on a regular basis, their frame of reference is a bottle. It's not even a glass. People don't even drink out of glasses anymore. And they don't even have any a concept of how much 8 ounces looks like, never mind, you know, what their needs are for the day for that. So, you know, and studies show people will eat what's in front of them no matter how big or large or big or small the plate is. And then also the liquid calories. The beverage industry has really contributed to a lot of additional calories and carbohydrate intake, which doesn't really fill a person up. So it's just going to, you know, add to the bottom line at the end of the day and of, you know, all the calories and refined carbohydrates they're consuming. So there's a lack of fiber in addition because people are eating more processed foods. So the fiber also is something that could help with, you know, controlling your blood sugar a little bit better and all that. So if people are eating more refined sugars and refined flour, they're just going to have, it's broken down into our systems. Everything we're consuming is broken down into blood glucose. But when you're eating things with more refined carbohydrates, your body processes it a little faster, and there's something known as the glycemic index, and the effect on our blood sugar on how fast it spikes after a meal. You know, most Americans are eating very high glycemic index foods.
Explain the glycemic index in a little more detail.
Okay, well, that's something that, I mean, you shouldn't really base a diet just on that, but I think it's a very effective way of making sure that the majority of your foods are on a low glycemic index that are coming from carbohydrate, meaning, just like I said, the actual impact on blood glucose post-meal. So certain foods will, there's like a glycemic index, there's ranging up to 100, I guess, and certain foods. And then there's the glycemic load. But I think, I mean, the simplest way of explaining it is just how fast your blood sugar is going to spike after consuming a certain type of food or carbohydrate. So the lower the glycemic index, there's usually a correlation with it having more fiber and other nutrients as well. like, you know, protein or fat that can help, you know, delay the onset of that glucose uptake. So it's, you know, it's important for people to be getting more whole foods in their diet because of the fact that there's more fiber contained in plant-based foods. And
what's the range on the glycemic index?
It ranges up to 100. So you want to have something that's lower on that range so that, you know, you're eating foods. I mean, there's different groupings, and I can guide you to websites. I mean, if you look at the diabetes.org website, they can guide you through the different types of
ranges. So the lower the number, the slower.
Yeah, the lower the number, the slower the rise in your blood glucose level. And that's optimal because we want to make sure that our body is utilizing all the nutrients, and it takes a little bit of time to digest and process everything and to give us good energy so that we're not having a huge spike in our blood sugar and then we're crashing. And many people could relate to what that feels like after having a meal that's really high in I guess, refined sugar. You get a lot of energy very, very fast, and then you feel very sluggish shortly after. And that's an example of how you would feel after eating a high glycemic index food versus a food that's lower. You'll have good energy and it's more sustained a few more hours after a meal, and you'd actually not have as much of a lull or type of slump.
And like you said, the consumption of fat and the consumption of protein help blunt that.
It helps blunt that, and it helps carry the person over and adds more to meal satiety. So most people, if they're eating a meal that has a little bit of healthy fat and some lean protein, can also make them feel full and satisfied. One of the things I counsel people with just even weight management and just the increasing the enjoyment of food is to be eating every 3 to 4 hours and within the first hour of waking up so that your body and your metabolism is working at your optimal level. And I always also remind people of the size of our stomach versus the size of a plate of food in front of you, and to think about, well, how is that your little stomach going to handle all that at one time? And then from there, it's not just the stomach that digests. The stomach just is starting the digestive process after we chew our food, and it ends up there. The intestinal tract is really where all the absorption of nutrients or majority of absorption of nutrients lies. And, you know, for things to move through your system, you should be eating small, frequent meals for the optimal uptake of the nutrients and energy levels. And therefore, I mean, it's probably the baseline of eating for controlling your diabetes is small, frequent meals.
And explain a good snack.
A good snack. Well, a good snack usually should have some sort of high fiber carbohydrate and some sort of healthy fat or lean protein. So an example could be some sort of vegetables. I love recommending for people to have, you know, vegetables with hummus. And hummus would be, it's a bean dip, essentially. It's usually made from, you know, garbanzo beans or chickpeas, a little bit of olive oil and tahini paste, which is sesame paste. So that's going to give you the carbohydrate from the actual legume or the beans with a little bit of protein that's naturally occurring in the bean with the healthy fat that's paired with it. And eating that with either, you know, whole grain crackers or, I guess, since people tend to really like hummus and they want to keep their calories in check, I recommend eating it with vegetables because then you can eat a little bit more hummus and you're a little more satisfied with that. It also provides lots of fiber as well. So a person eating a snack that's around 200 calories, that would be ideal, I'd say, depending on timing of the meal coming up and if you're going to exercise pre or post the snack. But a general guideline for a snack should be about 200 calories.
And a combination of fat, protein, and carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm. It could also be, you know, a slice of whole grain toast with peanut butter or almond butter. It could be, you know, a piece of fruit with, an ounce of nuts, something convenient. You know, it could also be a half a sandwich, you know, lean sandwich with some sort of lean protein or in some sort of real whole grain bread. Could be, you know, an organic yogurt, some berries that would be a little bit lower in glycemic index. So yogurt having a good amount of protein. Greek yogurt actually has a little bit more protein. It's a little more concentrated. That's always a good snack as well.
Now explain, how does exercise help in the prevention and the maintenance of diabetes?
Okay, so I'll first start with the prevention. So if a person has family members with diabetes, parents with diabetes, and they're really concerned and looking to, you know, avoid the early onset of it or avoid it altogether, A really good way to do that would be by maintaining a healthy weight and by exercising, because every time we exercise, our body actually has improved or better uptake of the glucose in our bloodstream and by the muscles in our liver. So it's actually optimal to exercise after a meal. I usually recommend for people, especially women with gestational diabetes, to go out and have a nice long walk after a meal, because your body can actually use up more of the glucose versus if you're just sitting there. So it really pays off for exercise to be part of your daily or routine or regimen to help with controlling your blood sugar, in addition to eating right and if you're on any medication, so that your body's working more efficiently with that.
So if you do have a genetic predisposition, mm-hmm. Having foods that are low glycemic index, exercising, those are just basic things you can do that would help offset. I mean, there's nothing that says this written in stone saying if you have a genetic predisposition to it, you're going to get it.
There's risk factors. I mean, at risk, it doesn't mean that you're doomed and you're going to have it. I would say even my own family history, I could possibly be at risk as well. We're not really sure if any of our other relatives may have had it, but it's pretty, in my mind, pretty clear that some of them had. Many families, I ask a lot of my clients, do you have a family history? And they're not sure, but they have a family history of obesity and certain people dying very young of, heart disease or, other complications that, they could have been one of that, population walking around with diabetes that they didn't know it, like we talked about earlier, and then that some of the other symptoms manifested, and that was the end result. So I have several relatives with that situation. So I think that, it's important to know what your risk factors are, but don't make that, you resist taking care of yourself because you think you're just going to have it anyway. So, taking ownership of your own lifestyle and to put into action the things you can control, and what you can control is what you're eating, how much you're moving, and also the quality of what you're eating as well. I can't emphasize that enough.
More common in men or women?
Good question. I think it's more common. Well, there's different, ethnic backgrounds that are more common in diabetes. I don't know. I'd have to look into that. But I would say across the board, we're both at risk. But there's certain populations and ethnic backgrounds that ethnicities that put people at higher risk. Like I said, like the Asian population, Hispanic and Black tend to be a little higher at risk. Versus the Caucasian population, but that goes out the window when everyone's eating the same amount of food and
the same crap
same
foods.
Lifestyle. So, but you have to look at the risk factor and also look at the lifestyle factors. So there's different, things contributing to people's food choices. So you have to look at socioeconomic levels and what is available to people, and the price of food is another thing to look at. What people can afford to eat, and they tend to go for the cheap food like I talked about. But one of the challenges I've had, as a dietitian over the past several years, counseling people from every background, is that no matter how much income you have, you still can consume a healthy diet. You just have to be very selective of what foods you're purchasing. But you could definitely last or survive on a very healthy diet with minimal funds per day. People just have to be aware and actually make it happen. And I think understanding how to cook, how to plan ahead, and recalibrating your palate to kind of understand the real taste of real food, especially if you've been brought up on more processed food or the fast food. So,
great, Catherine. How can people reach you? You have a website.
I do. You can actually reach me at, my website is www.nutrivert.com, and it's spelled NutriVert.com.
That's French.
Vert is green in French, and it's green nutrition. Environmental nutrition is a passion of mine, and being part of the Hunger and Environmental Nutrition Practice Group, we're a group of dietitians within the country that are really big advocates for promoting the legislative policies that we need to support our local farmers and to make food accessible for everyone, and not just you know, those with, you know, access and more or more privilege to have, be able to afford it, that everyone should be able to afford and have access to healthy food and safe food, safe, wholesome, you know, natural food.
So NutriVert, VERT.com.
Yes.
Okay. And if they have any questions, they could reach you through that website?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. You've been very informative and very helpful. I appreciate it. And hang on, we'll be back with wrapping up this episode of The Inner Athlete. Don't forget, you can visit us at innerathletetraining.com, innerathletetraining.com. Welcome back to The Inner Athlete, and again, thanks to Catherine Farrell for being our guest today. And just a final wrap-up, just want you guys to know we're wrapping up a video called The Inner Athlete Back to Basics Series. And this first installment is pretty neat. It's just all about how to do the basics, whether it's push-up, whether it's squat, whether it's the lunge. And because so many times, I see it all the time, especially when I see these boot camp classes going around, the instructors are great, they really motivate people, but it's so hard to spend quality time really explaining to people what has to be done and how do you prevent injury when you do certain movements. And that's what this video is all about. It really breaks down the basics, you know, the pull-ups, the push-ups, the lunges, and the squats. And it's just a real dissection of what these movements are. So whether you are doing them with weight on you or whether you're just doing your own body weight, it doesn't really matter. It's really the basics. And you'll learn how many times you do these things in your day-to-day life. I mean, after all, every time you sit down and stand up out of a chair, you're doing a squat. Every time you run up and down a flight of stairs, you're doing a lunge. You know, so once you understand how to do these things well and how to do them perfectly, they correlate into your day-to-day life and your day-to-day movement patterns very effectively. So that's coming in, just wrapping up a little companion book to go along with that to sort of fill in the details of the video. And then finishing up another e-book called Meditation in Motion, but I'll explain more about that another time. But anyway, that's it. Just wanted to give you that wrap-up. And like I said, the New Year's coming up. We have a whole new slew of guests that we'll be having on. And as we improve our studio and as things move along, we're going to be able to take live call-ins as well. So we got a lot of stuff moving. So, again, don't forget to visit us at innerathletetraining.com. If you have any questions or inquiries, you can reach us there at any time. All right. Thanks again for your support, and everybody stay well, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time on The Inner Athlete.